Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland. I'm your host Fraser, and it's a pleasure to have you join us once again as we continue our journey through the rich and intricate tapestry of Scotland's past. In our last episode, we took a detailed stroll down the cobbled streets of 12th century Scotland, exploring the daily life of an average Scot. We delved into their routines, their homes, the food they ate, and the challenges they faced. We contrasted the lives of the noblemen and clergy, painting a vivid picture of the social-political structure in Scotland. If you haven't had the chance to listen to that episode, I highly recommend it, as it offers a fascinating insight into the everyday life of our ancestors. Today, however, we're broadening our horizon. We're stepping out of the Scottish borders and onto the grand stage of Europe during the period of 1100 to 1200 AD. It's a time of dynamic change, of kingdoms vying for power, of cultural exchanges, and of wars that shaped the continent's history. How was Scotland perceived during this era? What role did it play in the larger European context? And equally important, how did the great powers of the time view this relatively small kingdom on the edge of the European world? Our narrative will weave through the relationships and the perceptions of England, the kingdom with which Scotland had the most complex and intertwined history. We'll explore the diplomatic ties, the familial connections between the Northern English lords and the Southern Scottish nobility, and the inevitable conflicts. Was England's goal to rule Scotland, or did it seek to simply recognise it as a permanent child power to its own dominating might? But our story doesn't end there. We'll look at how France, with its own ambitions and relationship with Scotland, perceived our nation. We'll travel to Flanders, a hub of medieval commerce, to understand their interactions with Scotland and the trade. The Holy Roman Empire, a political colossus of the time, had its own views and policies regarding Scotland, as did the papacy in Rome, whose spiritual authority reached far and wide. And then there were the Iberian powers and the Scandinavian kingdoms, each with their unique ties and perspective on Scotland. By the end of today's episode, you'll have a comprehensive view of Scotland's position in medieval Europe during this time, not just as an isolated island in the north, but as an active participant in the continental affairs of the time. So, without further ado, let's embark on this journey across medieval Europe during the 1100s to 1200s AD, starting with England's perspective on Scotland. Are you ready? Let us begin. As we delve into the complex web of medieval geopolitics, understanding England's view on Scotland during the 12th century is pivotal. This period was marked by fluctuating relations driven by both conflict and cooperation, shaping the narrative of these neighbouring nations. In the early 1100s, the relationship between England and Scotland was relatively cordial, partly due to the familial ties between the ruling classes. However, as the century progressed, this amenity had often strained by territorial ambitions and political manoeuvring. Think of, well, the Battle of the Standard. The English monarchy under rulers like Henry I and later Henry II viewed Scotland as a realm to be respected, yet also as a potential threat to their northern borders. The familial connections between the Northern Lords of England and the Southern Lords of Scotland played a crucial role in their interactions. Many Scottish nobles held lands in England and vice versa, creating a complex web of allegiances. Think of the De Bruce family, how their allegiances actually changed to support England during David I's reign, even though they had land in both sides of the border. And other Norman lords that David I did rise up in Scotland also, you know, ended up supporting him instead. The fluctuating allegiances was strong. Marriages between families from both sides of the borders were common, used as strategic tools to secure alliances and peace. However, these ties could also become sources of conflict, especially during succession disputes or territorial claims. The question of England's ultimate goal regarding Scotland is a subject of historical debate. While there were clearly periods where English monarchs sought to exert control over Scotland, particularly evident during the times of the Scottish succession crises later on, it's more nuanced than a mere desire for outright conquest. England's primary objective seemed to be the recognition of its position as the dominant power in the British Isles, ensuring its northern border was secure and free from external European influences, particularly from France, just so it could also focus on France. This goal often manifested in attempts to assert sovereignty over Scotland, rather than direct rule. In essence, England's view of Scotland during the 1100 to 1200 AD was complex, shaped by the blend of familial ties, political ambitions, and the overarching need for security and dominance in the British Isles. This dynamic would lay the groundwork for the centuries of interactions that followed between these two nations. England would want to conquer and invade France. Scotland would invade from the north, thus focusing England's attention back north again. This crisscross, this back and forth, would harm their relationship, and as we know, when it gets later on into the Scottish Independence Wars, we'll see how that comes to a head. Moving on to the continent itself now. During the 12th century, the geopolitical landscape of Europe was as intricate as it was dynamic, with Scotland playing a notable role in the broader narrative. Let's explore how France and Flanders, two significant powers of the time, perceived Scotland. France throughout this period had an evolving relationship with Scotland. Initially, the French, under the Capetian dynasty, were more than preoccupied with their own internal affairs and consolidating their own territory. However, as the century progressed, their attention increasingly turned towards external alliances. Though the formal alliance was later formalised in 1295 AD, the foundations of the Franco-Scottish alliance, known as the Eude Alliance, were being laid during the 12th century. France viewed Scotland as a strategic ally against England, especially given the historical conflicts over territories in France involving English kings. Marriages between Scottish royalty and French nobility were not uncommon and served as diplomatic tools to strengthen alliances between the two nations. These marriages often brought Scotland closer to France, both politically and culturally, even if it was as a junior partner. While political alliances were significant, France also saw Scotland as a trade partner. Cultural exchanges, particularly in the arts and education, were also notable, with Scots visiting France for further education and vice versa. Now, Flanders during this period was a prosperous region, known for its booming trade and commerce, especially in textiles. The Flemish perspective of Scotland was largely economic and opportunistic. Flanders viewed Scotland as an important trade partner. Scottish wool, like we went over in the last episode, was highly valued in Flemish cities like Bruges and Ghent, where it was a key raw material for their textile industry. In return, Scotland imported Flemish cloths and luxury goods. There was also significant movement of Flemish people to Scotland during this time. These immigrants were often merchants or skilled craftsmen, and their settlements in Scotland were viewed favourably by Flanders, strengthening economic and cultural ties. Politically, however, Flanders maintained a relatively neutral stance towards Scotland. Their primary interest lay in maintaining and expanding trade relations rather than engaging in political intricacies of Scottish affairs. So in summary, France's view of Scotland was increasingly influenced by the potential of a strategic alliance against Scotland, while Flanders focused more on the economic benefits of trade and cultural exchanges. These relationships, driven by a blend of politics, commerce and culture, played a significant role in shaping Scotland's position in medieval Europe. Further on, the Holy Roman Empire and the papacy stood as towering figures. Their interactions with Scotland, though nuanced, offer a glimpse into a complex web of power, religion, and diplomacy that defined the era. During the 12th century, the Holy Roman Empire, under the leadership of figures like Emperor Frederick I Barbarossa, reigned from 1152 to 1190 AD. He was largely preoccupied with its vast territories in Central Europe and Italy, as well as its ongoing conflict with the papacy, known as the Investiture Controversy, which reached a climax in the Concordat of Worms in 1122 AD. Scotland distant both geographically and in terms of immediate political concerns, was on the periphery of the Empire's vision. However, Scotland was not entirely off the Empire's radar. The Empire, known for its desire to expand Christendom and exert influence, would have recognised Scotland as an integral part of Christian West. The Empire's interest in Scotland was less about direct political control and more about acknowledging Scotland as a part of the European feudal tapestry. This acknowledgement was subtle yet significant, as it placed Scotland within the broader context of the Empire's worldview, where Christendom was the blinding force across desperate lands. The papacy, we've already talked a lot about them, but let's touch on them a bit more. The papacy in the 12th century under popes like Calcaticus II and Alexander III viewed Scotland through a distantly religious lens. This period was marked by a push for ecclesiastical reform and consolidation of papal authority. Scotland, predominantly Catholic and undergoing its own religious transformation as we know, fell squarely within the papacy's moral and spiritual judication. The reign of David, as we know in Scotland, was particularly significant for the papacy. David's efforts to reform the Scottish Church, aligning it more with closely Roman practices, were viewed favourably in Rome. His establishment of bishoprics and patronage of monasticism were in line with a papal vision for a reformed and orderly church. One notable example of papal interaction with Scotland during this period was the issue of the Bishop of St Andrews. In 1172, Pope Alexander III intervened in the dispute over the election of the bishop, a clear demonstration of the papal's willingness to involve itself in Scottish ecclesiastical affairs. Additionally, the Scottish Church reclaimed and wanted its independence from the secular control of England, and the model the papacy sought to replicate elsewhere. In a time when the papacy was struggling with the secular rulers of the investiture and other ecclesiastical matters, Scotland represented a more ideal balance between religious and royal powers. So in conclusion, the Holy Roman Empire recognised Scotland as a distant yet integral part of the Christian world, while the papacy saw Scotland as a key player in its religious agenda. These relationships, though not marked by direct intervention or overt political manoeuvring, were nonetheless crucial in situating Scotland within the larger European narrative of power, faith and diplomacy. But if we shift our focus a little bit further south towards the Iberian Peninsula, this comprised of kingdoms like Castile, Aragon, and Portugal. There's also the Scandinavian countries, primarily Norway, Denmark, and Sweden, each of them having their own distinct viewpoints shaped by their own political and cultural landscapes towards Scotland. The Iberian kingdoms during the 12th century were largely engaged in the Reconquista, the gradual Christian reclamation of the Iberian Peninsula from the Muslim rule. Their focus was inward and southward, but they were not oblivious to the broader European dynamics. The Iberian monarchs, particularly as they grew in power towards the late 12th century, began looking outward for alliances to consolidate their gains. Martial alliances with other European royal families, including Scotland's, were not uncommon. These alliances were more about cementing diplomatic ties and less about direct influence or control. The Iberian kingdoms recognising Scotland as a fellow Christian realm, the shared religious identity, particularly in the face of Muslim presence in southern Spain, created a sense of camaraderie and mutual respect among these Christian kingdoms. While not as extensive as Flanders or France, there was some trade between Scotland and the Iberian kingdoms. Scottish wool and other goods would have found their way to Iberian markets, a bit on a smaller scale. Now, the Scandinavian perspective on Scotland was shaped significantly by the historical interactions, especially the Viking Age, which had seen extensive Norse settlement and influence in Scotland. Now, we did do an entire episode on Scandinavian Scotland, so we'll keep this brief. If you want a deeper dive, head to that episode first. But in short, by the 12th century, the direct Norse influence in Scotland had waned, but the historical ties remained. Places like the Orkney and Shetland Islands, which were under Norwegian control, served as a remainder of these deep connections. The Norwegian crown in particular viewed Scotland as a region of interest, mainly due to its proximity and historical claims. The period saw occasional conflicts and negotiations over territories like the Hebrides, reflecting a relationship that oscillated between rivalry and cooperation. The long history of Norse settlement in Scotland meant the cultural exchanges were ongoing, even as political control diminished. In summary, Scotland was viewed by the Iberian powers as a distant yet respected fellow Christian kingdom, occasionally connected through diplomatic and martial ties, and by the Scandinavian powers as a land with historical and cultural connections often intertwined with political interests and territorial claims. Now what about the trade? We did touch on trade a tiny bit in the last episode, but trade during this era was an essential facet of life as we know. Connecting the Scottish economy to the wider world was crucial. Scotland's trade relationships were fostered not just by the proximity, but also by the demand for its natural resources and strategic alliances it forged. The primary partners in trade were those with which Scotland had both political ties and complementary economic needs. Now we know England, given its proximity and intertwined history, was a crucial trade partner. Despite the hostilities, commerce flowed relatively freely, especially in periods of peace. Scotland's relationship with France would later become formalised, as we know, so trade in wool, hides, and even in early exports of coal found their way to French markets. The Flemish cities were major centres of cloth production and trade in medieval Europe. Scottish wool was highly sought after in Flanders, making it a vital trade partner. In Scandinavia, the historical ties due to the Viking settlements in Scotland facilitated trade with Norway and other Scandinavian territories. Timber, fish, and wool were commonly traded items. There's also the Low Countries. Apart from Flanders, other regions of the Low Countries, such as the emerging trade power of the Hanseatic League, were becoming increasingly important as trade partners for Scottish goods. Now, what about the trade flow? How did the trade go from one place to another? So let's have a look at the direction of the Scottish trade during this period. Southward to England, some trade went, and through it to the continent. Eastward across the North Sea to the thriving markets of Flanders and the Low Countries. North-eastward to the Scandinavian countries, continuing the old Viking trade routes. And across the channel to ports of France, with which cultural and political ties were strengthening. These trading relationships were underpinned by maritime routes that were becoming increasingly secure and reliable movements of goods. The trade items exchanged were diverse, from primary goods such as wool, hides and timber, to finished products like Flemish cloth and luxury goods from the continent. But what about its imports? What did Scotland import into its land during its time? Well, from Flanders and the Low Countries, Scotland imported fine cloth, which was a prized commodity across Europe. Flemish and Low Countries textiles were renowned for their quality and were sought after by Scottish elite. France, whom Scotland had burgeoning political ties with, provided not only luxury goods but also wine, which was becoming increasingly popular among the Scottish nobility, especially the Norman one. The wine trade with France would eventually become a significant aspect of Scottish imports. The historical connections with the Norse world meant that Scotland's imported items like timber and possibly certain types of ironwork and tools from Scandinavia, which were essential for both everyday life and for shipbuilding. And what about England and Ireland? While often considered rivals, these neighbours were also trade partners as we know. From England, Scotland imported various goods, possibly including ceramics and refined metalworks. Ireland, though less economically developed, also participated in this trade work, a bit to a lesser extent. The trade in Scotland during this era was also facilitated by the several key ports, which served as gateways for international trade. Berwick-upon-Tweed, arguably one of the most important Scottish ports in the 12th century, Berwick was ideally situated for trade with the continent, especially with the Low Countries. Its location near the English border also made it a crucial point for Anglo-Scottish trade. Edinburgh and Leith. While Edinburgh was growing as a political centre, Leith, its port was developing into a major maritime hub, facilitating trade across the North Sea. Aberdeen. Known for its natural harbour, Aberdeen was a significant port engaging in trade with both Scandinavia and the Low Countries. And then finally, Dundee. Dundee's port also played a role in Scotland's maritime trade, politically in the later part of the 12th century. These ports were lifelines of Scotland's economy, bustling with merchants, sailors, and goods from across Europe. They were not just commercial centres, but also melting pots of cultural exchanges where ideas, languages, and traditions intermingled, contributing to the dynamic medieval Scottish society. As we explore the European context of the 12th century, it's essential to understand the pivotal developments in neighbouring regions, notably England, Ireland, and the Scandinavian countries. Each had its own unique trajectory during this period, impacting their relationship with Scotland and the broader European dynamics. England in the 12th century was a realm of significant transformation and turmoil. The century commenced under the rule of Henry I, as we know, who sought to stabilise the country after the upheaval of the Norman Conquest. His reign marked a period of relative peace and administrative efficiency, with the implementation of key legal and bureaucratic reforms. The introduction of the Exchequer around 1110, a system for managing royal finances, was a notable achievement. However, stability was short-lived. Henry I's death in 1135 led to a succession crisis, as we know as the Anarchy, a civil war-like situation dominated by a power struggle between his daughter, Empress Matilda, and his nephew, Stephen of Blois. This era was characterized by widespread disorder and conflict, severely impacting social and economic life. The latter part of the century saw the rise of the Plantagenet dynasty, with Henry II ushering in a phase of legal reform and centralization of power. His reign, however, was not without conflict, marked by his tumultuous relationship with the one and only Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury, culminating in Becket's murder in 1170 AD, and his struggles with his sons and wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine. And obviously his sons are, well, Henry, but also Richard the Lionheart, and John of Lackland. We'll hear more of them as we go through our history in our political narrative. Ireland's 12th century narrative was one of a fragmented political authority. The concept of a high king existed, but real power was often in the hands of regional kings and local chieftains. This period saw frequent conflicts between these regional powers. The landscape began to shift dynamically with the arrival of the Normans in 1169 AD. Initiated by the deposed King of Leinster, who sought Norman assistance to regain his throne. This incursion, which received tacit approval from Henry II of England, marked the beginning of significant Norman influence in Ireland. By the end of the century, large parts of Ireland were under Norman control, leading to profound social, political, and cultural changes. Now, if we look across the sea towards Scandinavia, the 12th century was a time of consolidation and expansion. Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, each with their own monarchies, were engaged in both internal consolidation and external adventures. Norway saw significant developments under kings like Sigurd I, who led the Norwegian Crusade between 1107 and 1110 AD, and Magnus IV, who reigned between 1130 and 1135 AD. The period also saw the Norwegian Civil Wars, which began in the 1130s and would continue into the next century. In Sweden, the era was marked by the establishment of the Archdiocese of Upper Silesia by Stefan, a pivotal moment in this Swedish church history, signifying its growing independence and importance. Denmark, under kings like Erik I and Vladimir the Great, expanded its influence over the Baltic region and participated in the Northern Crusades, which began in the late 12th century. More on that in a future episode. Throughout this period, the Scandinavian kingdoms, though often dealing with their own internal issues, remained aware of developments in the rest of Europe, including Scotland, forging ties through trade, marriages, and sometimes conflict. If we look to other countries now, let's look towards France and Flanders during the 12th century. It becomes clear that this was a time of significant transformation and growth for both countries. The 12th century in France was a period marked by the gradual strengthening of royal power under the Capetian dynasty. The century began under the rule of King Louis VI, who reigned between 1108 and 1137 AD, also known as Louis the Fat. His reign focused on consolidating the monarchy's control over the unruly French barons, thereby stabilizing the kingdom after years of feudal chaos. The narrative of French royalty took a dynamic turn when the reign of King Louis VII, who reigned between 1137 and 1180, began to have, let's say, not so good ties with England. One of the most notable events of his reign was his marriage to Eleanor of Aquitaine, one of the most wealthiest and most powerful women in Western Europe. Their marriage, however, was annulled in 1152 AD, leading Eleanor, like we said earlier, to marry the future King Henry II of England, a union that dramatically shifted the balance of power between England and France, pretty much giving England quite a lot of control of France and France becoming quite small. The latter part of the century was dominated by the reign of Philip II Augustus from 1180 to 1223 AD, who ascended the throne as a teenager. His reign was a turning point for France as he successfully expanded the kingdom's territories and curtailed the power of the English Plantagenet kings in France, notably regaining control of significant territories during his conflicts with King Richard the Lionheart of England and King John. Philip II's involvement in the Third Crusade further asserted France's role in European affairs. I think we'll do a catch-up on the Crusades, maybe touch on the Third Crusade and obviously the Crusade that ended the Byzantine Empire also in a future episode. I think I might place it either during the Wars of Independence or just before. But anyway, regardless, France was undergoing a renaissance with the development of Gothic architecture, exemplifying by the construction of Notre Dame in Paris, which began in 1163 AD. This period also saw a flourishing of art and literature, laying the foundation for France's cultural dominance in Europe. During the same period, Flanders was experiencing unparalleled prosperity and growth. It was one of the most valued and urbanized, economically developed regions in Europe. Cities like Bruges, Ghent, and Ypres were bustling hubs of commerce and trade, known particularly for their wool and textile industries. The Counts of Flanders, such as Baldwin, who ruled until 1119 AD, skillfully navigated their position between their nominal French overlords and the rising power of the Holy Roman Empire to the east. Under their leadership, Flanders became a crucial intermediary in European trade, connecting the markets of England, the Scandinavian regions, and the rest of the continent. The Flemish cities were not just economic centres, however, but also melting pots of cultural exchange, as we know with the Scottish ones. Their prosperity attracted artists, craftsmen and traders from all over Europe, turning Flanders into a vibrant and diverse region. The Flemish Fair, an annual event in these cities, was a highlight in the European economic calendar, drawing merchants from far and wide. In summary, both Flanders and France in the 12th century were regions of immense activity and development. France under the Capetians was consolidating its power and setting the stage for future expansion, while Flanders was enjoying the fruits of economic prosperity and cultural vibrance. These developments in France and Flanders were not isolated but played a significant role in the broader European context. If we look to Flanders east now, the 12th century for the Holy Roman Empire was a period marked by significant control and consolidation. The early part of the century saw the empire embroiled in the investiture controversy, a major conflict between Emperor Henry V and Pope Gregory. This struggle, which revolved around who held authority to appoint bishops and abbots, culminated in the Congress of Worms in 1122 AD, a landmark agreement that partially resolved the conflict by delineating the powers of the Pope and the Emperor. The heart of the century was dominated by the region and reign of Frederick I Barbarossa from 1152 to 1190, a figure who sought to reassert imperial dominance in Italy and strengthen the empire's authority. His reign was characterized by a series of campaigns in Italy, where he aimed to bring the rebellious cities of the Lombard League under imperial control. However, these campaigns often brought him into direct conflict with the papacy and the Italian city-states, culminating in the catastrophic defeat of the Battle of Legnano in 1176 AD, where Barbarossa suffered a significant defeat. Barbarossa's involvement in the Third Crusade marked another key chapter in Europe's history. His untimely death during the Crusade, or albeit on the way to the Crusade, Third Crusade, in 1190, was a setback for the Empire and symbolised the end of the era. And also, if I'm honest, didn't really help the Third Crusade a lot either, but we'll save that for a future episode, as I said. What about the Iberian Peninsula? Well, we know the Iberian Peninsula had kingdoms of Castile, Aragon, and Portugal, who were actively involved in pushing back the Muslim Moors from the south. The early part of the century saw figures like Alfonso of Leon and Castile mark significant gains against the Moors, including the capture of Toledo in 1085 AD. The period also witnessed the emergence of Portugal as a significant power under the leadership of Alfonso I, who reigned from 1139 to 1185 AD, who declared the independence of Portugal from Leon and laid the foundations for a distinct Portuguese identity. The latter half of the century saw the Christian kingdoms further consolidate their gains. The capture of significant cities like Lisbon in 1147 AD by Portuguese forces under Alfonso I, with the help of crusaders, marked a turning point in the Reconquista. Similarly, the Kingdom of Aragon under rulers like Alfonso I and Ramon Berenguer expanded its territory through a mix of military campaigns and diplomatic marriages, like that of Ramon and Pedro of Aragon, uniting the kingdoms of Aragon and Barcelona. This century was not just about conflict, but was also about cultural flourishing. The coexistence of Christian, Muslim, and Jewish communities led to significant cultural and intellectual exchanges, making cities like Toledo centers of learning and translation. Now, I apologize for butchering any Spanish names there, but yeah, I just always struggle with Spanish. I was never good in school with any Spanish in my entire life. But regardless, in summary, the 12th century saw both the Holy Roman Empire and Iberian kingdoms with significant political and cultural evolution. The empire grappled with internal and external challenges, striving to maintain its authority, while the Iberian kingdoms continued their push against Muslim rule with a Reconquista, setting the stage for the future shape of the peninsula, and obviously the Spanish growth of a combined kingdom. As we draw the curtains on today's exploration of Scotland and its interaction with the European stage during the 1100 to 1200 AD period, it's important to acknowledge the rich tapestry of sources that have informed our journey. Yes, we're going to do that again because, well, these next three episodes are quite vast. There's a lot of information I'm giving you. Last episode was quite short, but this episode's already over 30 minutes. So I want to give you guys extra reading if you do want to go ahead and learn more about these extra histories, let's say, you know, of history of France, etc. So we've delved into the complexities of medieval European politics, trade, and culture, drawing from a wealth of historical scholarship. The key references I used for this episode include the seminal work from The Kingdom of Scots by J.W.S. Barrow, which offers an in-depth look into Scotland's political landscape during the Middle Ages. Medieval Scotland, Crown, Lordship, and Community by Alexander Grant and Keith J. Stringer provides valuable insights into Scotland's relationship with its European neighbours. So that is Medieval Scotland, Crown, Lordship and Community by Alexander Grant and Keith J. Stringer. Additionally, the New Cambridge Medieval History, edited by David Luscombe and Jonathan Riley Smith, has been instrumental in shaping our understanding of this era, especially in contextualizing Scotland within the broader European narrative. Now, what about podcasts? What about other podcasts you could listen to? Well, I'm just going to do a few shout-outs. Anglo-Saxon England is a very good podcast that goes through Anglo-Saxon England. You've got obviously the History of England podcast, which is great. There's a History of France podcast out there. There's a Holy Roman Empire one. There's a Reconquista podcast. Just have a look on iTunes, Spotify, anywhere. You'll find all these great historical podcasts. I listen to quite a lot of them and they help shape my own episodes. So I really recommend, if you don't want to read and you actually just want to listen to it in an audio format, give them a listen. Anyway, I hope this episode has provided you with a nuanced understanding of Scotland's place in medieval Europe, showcasing its interactions with neighbouring powers and highlighting the intricate web of diplomacy, trade and conflict in Europe. While our overview has been brief, the impact and significance of these relationships in shaping Scotland's history are profound. Apologies again if I've rushed over anyone's histories of any of the countries or events. We've only got so much time to go over, as you know. Looking ahead, our next episode will mark the end of this mini-series, where we'll delve into the 12th and 13th century Scottish military tactics, a fascinating aspect of Scotland's medieval history and the warfare during this period. This episode will set the stage for our exploration of David I's grandson, Malcolm IV, and the continuation of Scotland's intriguing story. Remember, our podcasts are released weekly and the next episode will be available next week. For regular updates and more fascinating insights into Scottish history, follow us on Twitter at TheHistoryOfSC1 or join our Facebook community at The History of Scotland Podcast. Your engagement and feedback are what keep this journey through Scotland's past alive and thriving. We're actually nearly at 40 members, I think we're on 37 at the moment on Facebook, so if we can try and push for 40, that'd be great. Please do give it a join. You can keep up to date with when I'm going to release episodes, and we can be engaged in any historical discussions if you wish. If you've enjoyed today's episode, also please leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. Your reviews help us reach more historical enthusiasts like you. You can listen to our podcasts on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Podbean. There's also many other great podcasting platforms that I've got our podcast released back on, so maybe give them a shot as well. All that is to say is thank you for joining us today. I look forward to continuing our exploration of Scotland's rich history in our upcoming episodes. So until then, have a great week, guys. Stay safe and goodbye. Peace.